Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. We are delighted that tonight's program is part of the Club's Good Lit series, which is generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our very distinguished speaker, Manal Hajratwala. Manal Hajratwala is the author of Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents, which has been called Incomparable by Alice Walker and Searingly Honest by The Washington Post. The book won a Penn USA Award, an Asian American Writers Workshop Award, a Lambda Literary Award, a California Book Award, Silver Nonfiction, and was shortlisted for the Saroyan International Writing Prize. Manal spent 7 years researching and writing the book, traveling the world to interview more than 75 members of her extended family. Manal is a Fulbright senior research scholar, spending the 2010-2011 academic year in India researching a novel, while also writing poems about the unicorns of the 5,000-year-old Indus Valley civilization. She is editor of the Queer Ink Anthology, Contemporary LGBT Stories of India, forthcoming in 2012 from Queer Ink Publishing. Her creative work has received recognition and support from the Sundance Institute, the John Sims Center for the Arts, the Serpent Source Foundation, and the Hedgebrook Writing Retreat for Women, where she has served on the Alumni Leadership Council. As a journalist, she has worked at the San Jose Mercury News from 1992 to 2000 as an editor, reporter, and the newspaper's first reader representative. She was a National Arts Journalism Program Fellow for Columbia University in 2000-2001, and she's also a graduate of Stanford University. Please join me in welcoming Manal Hajratwala.
Good evening, and thank you so much for that kind introduction. I am happy to be here, and I want to begin with a bit of history. On October 3, 1965, just before signing a piece of legislation that had been decades in the making, in a ceremony at the Statue of Liberty, President Lyndon Johnson said, "This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power." In fact, the bill he signed that day was the Immigration Act of 1965, and it would reshape not only the daily lives of millions, but also American immigration policy itself. It was a complete reversal of decades of exclusion, particularly the exclusion of people from America on the basis of race. For the first time since 1882, America admitted Asians on the same terms as all other peoples of the world, and the reason for this dramatic change was, of course, the Cold War. Every major shift in American immigration policy since this nation's founding has been based on the need for a particular type of labor and the sense that immigrants could provide that labor. Earlier policies were based on the new nation's need for homesteaders, then for railroad workers, miners, farmers, and in the 1960s, instead of bodies, what America needed was brains. By that time, the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union had become a national obsession, evident in every element of pop culture, from children's toys to the space race. Now that we've lived a couple of decades in a world with just one superpower, it's easy to forget what it was like when there were two superpowers in the world. American competition versus the Soviet Union was measured by every conceivable scorecard, from the number of medals won at the Olympics to the number of nuclear bombs in our respective arsenals to the number of scientists from the third world that each nation could attract. And so Team America was particularly eager at that moment to recruit educated, skilled immigrants. The opening up of U.S. borders to these specially selected immigrants was just one strategy in the Cold War. This policy and similar ones in other Western nations at the time led to a phenomenon called the brain drain, which was a term for the movement of the so-called best and brightest from their home countries, which said that they really needed that talent, to the West, which could pay more and offer more attractive living conditions and career opportunities. Most of these migrants in the 1960s came from India and China because of both the sheer size of those populations and because of certain educational policies in those countries. And if you had said back then that within less than 50 years the tide would turn and that the race to become the next superpower would happen between India and China and the Soviet Union would be completely out of the picture, and if you had said back then that in fact Americans would be moving over there because the opportunities were better and that someday we would find large numbers of multinational companies relocating their operations to India and hiring not only Indian citizens but also drawing talent from all over the world, including the First World, it would have been like predicting the appearance of unicorns in India. My parents were part of that brain drain generation of the 1960s, and as a result of their migration to the United States, I was born here in San Francisco, and I grew up basically American, although I had relatives all over the world in 9 different countries. And over time, I became curious because I realized that not everyone had family in India and Africa and Fiji and Hong Kong and Australia and so on. And I set out to find how that had happened, not only in my family, but also, as it turns out, across the world with Indians. In our families, migration stories are often told like this. Your grandfather wanted to go to Fiji, so he went. And the motives are seen as purely personal, almost arbitrary. But as I did my research, which took me all over the world over the course of a year, 40,000 miles, 100 interviews, I also started looking at academic models and theories and narratives which tell another story of migration. The classic model of migration is of push and pull, which always reminds me of the two-headed push-me-pull-you from Dr. Doolittle. The only way that the push-me-pull-you can move is if one pushes and the other one pulls at precisely the same moment. And this is about how the migration theory of push and pull also works. So over there are the push factors. It's bad, you're poor, maybe you don't have enough freedom, etc. And over here it's good. There's money, freedom, progress, opportunity. So when you have push and pull at the same time, it is obvious which way the animal should move. And this idea, this theory, fits quite beautifully with the American conception of itself as a superpower and the story of the American dream, which was that people from all over the world longed to come here because the pull factors were so strong. Push-pull worked just like gravity, pulling people from the margins to the center, and the center was the United States. As with every myth, there is some seed of truth to this, and a myth, a story, can also become self-fulfilling. The more people believe it, the truer it is. So Asian Americans who were allowed and encouraged to become Americans during this period, precisely because they had certain educational and professional qualifications, were then labeled as a model minority. And this was ascribed to certain cultural characteristics, completely ignoring the fact that the model types, the people with higher education and specific professional skills, were precisely the ones who had been allowed to come in to this country. Today's Indian diaspora is estimated at about 26 million people all over the world, including the 2.7 million people in the United States. And as I explored more deeply the question of how this happened, both in my family and in the larger Indian diaspora, I found a lot of different kinds of origin myths about diaspora. So not only personal desire, but also economics, politics, the needs of various empires, etc. And I set out to tell the story in a way that would encounter the meeting place between personal character and larger forces of history. I deliberately wanted to complicate the picture, not to tell the push-pull story, not to tell the story of I felt like going, so I went, but to see how these two things could fit together. And I built each chapter of Leaving India around one person in my family and his or her moment of migration, and the political, cultural, social, economic forces that were taking place in both countries at that moment. And I asked why, and I asked why again. So, as Americans, I think that if we accept our own myths and we forget to ask why, if we refuse to see the complexity of the global picture, which does not always have us as at its center, and if we persist in believing that people come here just to live out the American dream, we will miss things. Now, at this moment, more than ever, we will miss the richness of the stories and the textures of the lives. And when the American dream loses a bit of its luster, as it has a little over the past several years of warfare and its accompanying recession, we will miss the fact that these migrants, particularly the skilled ones, the ones with education and with choices, the ones we have said we want here, will leave. They will find other places to live out their dream. They may not come at all in the first place. They will find other superpowers to build. Because push and pull are actually not so simple. Everyone's story in the end is both unique and universal. And nowhere have I found this more true than in my own life. If you had told me a couple of years ago, when I was sitting in my beautiful, foggy San Francisco apartment with the bay windows, working on the book that would become Leaving India, that one day soon I would make a migration myself in the opposite direction, that I would be unleaving India, so to speak, I might have accused you again of unicorn thinking. And yet, as I've now begun the process of moving to India myself, I find that my reasons are the exact mix of factors that motivated my ancestors' migrations as well. There's some combination of desire and greater freedom and opportunity in the new place, as well as a kind of stagnation, both economic and psychological, in the old. And the sense of which place is new and which place is old has been inverted. And in sensing this, I find also that I am hardly alone. In fact, to my surprise, I'm part of a migration trend, a minor one, but one that is sometimes called reverse migration. The reverse migration story has gotten a certain amount of press in both the U.S. and India. It's the fact that several thousand people of Indian origin, like myself, are now opting to move to India to work and live there, despite having spent most of our lives, or all of our lives, or maybe even several generations overseas. In India, all of us are called non-resident Indians. Even if we've been non-resident for five generations, it's as if we just happen to be out of the country for a while. And the return of NRIs is a kind of prodigal son and daughter story. So it has a natural appeal factor, natural drama, nostalgia, emotion. But although I am a part of this story, I actually think it's not the most important story. It is only a symptom of a much bigger story, which is, of course, globalization and its consequences. When I came back to the United States from India last week, after living and writing there for 10 months, which was a sort of trial period for me, a friend of mine in Chicago asked me, "What do I as an American need to know about India and Pakistan?" And I said, "Thomas, what you need to know is that India and Pakistan is the same story. It's been for a while, and that story is going on. But the real story is about India and America, and the fact that over there in India, there is a widespread understanding that the age of the United States as a sole superpower is over. Over there, it's quite clear that whether it's 5 years or 10 or a generation, a new superpower is about to emerge. And the only question for Indians is whether that superpower will be India or China. And this race to become the world's next superpower is fueling a pace of change and a series of subtle revolutions that we here in the United States are completely failing to see, because the stories that make it through to our consciousness are fueled by our own narcissism, I'm sorry to say. It might well be a self-fulfilling prophecy, this emergence of superpower, because of course economics is largely a function of, if not mass hysteria, then at least mass psychology. But if the 1.2 billion people in India come to believe and come together around a consensual reality as one-fifth of the planet, they have a significant impact on shaping that reality. Here in the U.S., we're missing some of that reality, because the stories we seem to find most fascinating about India have to do with our own consensual reality. And so we're interested in the so-called war on terror and in outsourcing, also known as stealing American jobs. And when it comes to migration, we seem to be most interested in things like reverse migration or the tendency now of H-1B visa holders, skilled technical workers, to go back to their homelands in Asia rather than to stay here. Those are the kinds of stories that catch our headlines and our attention, on top of the fashion stories and, of course, the yoga, meditation, seeking enlightenment stories that have fascinated Americans, at least since the age of Lyndon Johnson and the Beatles and my parents' immigration. Reverse migration is sometimes also called circular migration. And so just before I left Bombay, I went to a talk where the Indian head of McKinsey Consulting said quite cheerfully that he was able to hire Harvard Business School graduates going back to India just for the excitement of being there at this moment of growth. Obviously, that excitement is enhanced by the fact that things are a little weak here in terms of the economy. And so, again, we're seeing a simple kind of push me, pull you type Dr. Doolittle explanation of migration, that people can be pushed in this direction or that based on bad and good factors. I'm not discounting any of these anecdotal accounts or theories, but I do think that the real reason these items capture our attention is that they are mirroring a kind of ennui that we're feeling here in the United States. They echo the sad story that America is now telling itself about recession and economic stagnation and the loss of the American dream, and most of all of how the United States is a victim of globalization. What these narratives mask, I think, is a much larger picture. Just as push me, pull you, and the American dream did not actually describe the shape and growth and sprawl of the diaspora over the entire world over the last 150 years, I think reverse or circular migration does not describe the consequences of globalization on identity and choices about residence and work that people are making in their actual lives. With regard to migration to India in particular, I want to highlight two other trends that are not getting the same attention, but that I think are much more significant. First is the emergence of a kind of global citizen who is comfortable moving back and forth and onwards to wherever there's opportunity. In fact, I think most of the so-called reverse migrants are rather opportunistic. They may be in India for a while, but if the tide turns, they'll return home, or maybe they'll move on to a third country. They are going where the going is good and where there's a chance for them and their families and their loved ones, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's a very American value in some ways. And I think it's important to see that that migration is as temporary as anything else and is shaped by the conditions and causes that are present in our economy right now and in those economies right now, not to see them as some kind of nostalgic declaration of loyalty to a homeland that is somehow pulling them back irresistibly. The second thing that I see happening, and I think this is even more significant, although even less covered, is the return of foreign nationals to India after their educations, after a few years of work experience abroad. And these are people who have the cultural competence to actually create change within India. They know the systems there, and they know how to work within them, and they also are bringing back some of the technical skills and the business values and the critical thinking skills that they've picked up in the West, and they're using those skills. And in addition to bringing back skills, they're investing not some portion of their money, not a new venture to supplement their ventures overseas, but 100% of their money in India. They are buying property, they're settling down with their families, because they never really intended to leave. And the truth about migration in any era is that most people who migrate don't intend to migrate. They think that they're going for a short while. This was true of the people who came to the United States for education in their 20s and who stayed here because this is where the jobs were. At that time, India could not absorb those people. It didn't have the infrastructure for their talents. And today it does. Today it can take those people back, many of them, and give them opportunities. And that capacity over there is expanding. So the takeaway of this talk that I hope, if you remember just one thing, it will be, is that as Americans, it's really important to take ourselves out of the center of the story, to really try to see where is the new center or where are the multiple points of view so that we can understand what's really going on. And this is a lesson that immigrants learn over and over, that the world is complex, it's multifaceted, that you have a lot to learn, and that there is magnificence and richness in that complexity in the new stories we find. For everything that one can say about India, of course, the opposite is also true. And I want to just close with two examples of how that is and how that's been for me, because the process of moving to another country is complicated always, to say the least. It used to be that going to India meant being shocked by utter, abject, and widespread poverty. This time when I went, I was rather more shocked by the wealth. When I moved to Bombay last October, I ended up renting an apartment down the lane from the world's most expensive single-family home. Every day I walked past this brand-new 27-story building that my neighbors referred to simply as the monstrosity, and that was built by one of India's richest men at a cost of $1 billion, that's dollars, for his family of five, along with hundreds of servants. It has three helicopter pads on the roof and a panoramic view of the slums. In Bombay, 8 million people live without basic services such as running water, plumbing, and permanent shelter. So while it is true that there is money and opportunity in India now for some, incredible sums of money actually that seem almost imaginary, and while it is also true that that money is leading to glowing magazine stories and shiny new cars and malls and fashions and the kind of optimism that goes with an economic bubble, as those of us who are veterans of Silicon Valley remember, the talk of a game-changing economy, an escape from boom and bust economic cycles, a new economy on which all boats are going to rise, with that rising tide, is a bit too familiar to me. In India, the opposite of this new wealth still persists. Globalization has its brutalities. The poverty there is a constant reminder of that, and it's growing, it's deepening the divide, it's threatening the rise of the superpower. The second story that I want to tell is about this place called Dholavira, which dates from 2500 BC. It's in the northwest of India, near Gujarat, which is incidentally an area that's become quite well lauded lately for attracting significant overseas investment. And Dholavira was excavated just recently in the 1990s. In contrast to the old model of archaeology, which was basically plunder, where Westerners would go in and take the things that most interested them and sock them away in, say, the British Museum. This excavation was conducted by a multinational team of archaeologists under Indian leadership, and the large collection of artifacts remains mostly in India in the national museums, but available to researchers from all over the world. The site is remote, but it's open to the public, and so I was able to visit. And among the findings there are some of the oldest images in the world of a one-horned beast, hundreds of them, unicorns. So in India today, it seems that anything is possible. Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Manal Hajratwala, author of Leaving India, for her comments here today. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Manal, we have a large number of questions, so let's begin. One person asked, I'm moving back to India. What do you like the most and the least since you've moved back?
As a writer, what I like the most is that you cannot walk 2 feet in India without tripping over a story. So I feel like for me, my creativity and my productivity have skyrocketed since I've been there. I want to write every minute. I just don't have enough time to write. I haven't felt a minute of writer's block since I've been there. So for me, that's been the most amazing thing. And I think for anyone with an intellectual curiosity and a desire to learn, I feel like in India, I learn something every single day. And some days I think, okay, wait, do I really have to learn this right now? I'm a little tired, but I do. And it's amazing. Obviously there are challenges to being in India, and the biggest one I would say for me is noticing how often my own assumptions that I didn't even have any consciousness about are challenged. Things that I take for granted, like running water and plumbing, are not things that people take for granted on a daily basis. There are even people in the middle classes. The power goes out a lot. The water stops coming a lot, and these are day-to-day things that people deal with. And I think that in our part of the world where we have this amazing infrastructure and we have an infrastructure that is appropriate for the population that we have, we just miss the fact that these are huge challenges for a lot of the world. So I think for me the challenge is not exactly the sort of living conditions, but just the seeing my own assumptions and seeing my own privilege, actually, and noticing how much I have been shaped by the privilege of being an American and living in what is really one of the wealthiest lifestyles in the world, even though I myself in the United States may not always feel like I have a lot of money, and I certainly don't as an independent writer. But compared to most people on the globe, I have an immense amount of privilege.
Thank you. Also, 2 weeks ago, the Commonwealth Club hosted a speaker about Muslims of India. What are your observations of the current conditions of Muslims in India? Do you have any insights on
that? I think that's a really big question. India has a larger Muslim population than any other country in the world, as you all probably know. And I think that there's a range of experiences and conditions. And in India, really, from my point of view, and this is outside my area of expertise, but so from my limited point of view, I'll say that it seems to me that the major factor that shapes life in India is class. And so someone who is poor and Muslim and someone who is poor and Hindu have a lot more in common than someone who is very poor or very rich from the same religious community. And I think, again, you know, as I said, anything one says about India can be combated quite easily, because I'm sure there are communities where that is not the case and where people are quite tight regardless of class differences. So I really don't have a lot to say about that, except that, you know, there is certainly a sense of Muslims as a minority, and I think that to the extent that the war on terror mentality of ethnic profiling has spread into India, the conditions are difficult for people who are on the receiving end of that kind of profiling.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to India and Her Fragments, Migrations from Old to New Worlds, with author Manal Hajratwala. Manal, India's path to a superpower, excuse me, how does corruption play a role in that?
Corruption is obviously one of the biggest problems, and within India, the conversation is often around, again, this race between India and China, and there are pros and cons on both sides. So on the Indian side, the cons are considered to be corruption and, ironically, to some extent, democracy, because China is widely perceived to be much more organized and India is rather chaotic. And so there's a sense that that could be a weakness for India. I don't have any objective line on these things. For me as a writer, what I'm most interested in are the stories that people tell themselves at particular moments. The other big storyline in India is that English is a big benefit, and I think that objectively is true, that India has up till now had a larger capacity of English-speaking people, but I think China is really quickly catching up on that. And corruption is deeply entrenched, and it is there in a way that I think even those of us who are quite liberal and progressive in this country and perceive our own government as corrupt in certain ways, and we know that lobbying money plays too great a role in Washington and all of that, it's difficult to translate that to the Indian context, where corruption also means that you might not sometimes get your letter mailed if you don't know the proper bribe to pay to the postman. And here, it's largely a factor, again, of economics, because government workers, city workers, clerks, menial workers in a lot of jobs get paid very, very little, and they are expected to supplement their wages with money on the side. And as an Indian who's raised in India, one knows how to navigate those situations. As an outsider, one has no idea. And so I feel like it will take me a long time to understand those informal systems and informal relationships. Yeah.
Thank you. Manal, getting back to your book, you said it's divided. Each family member has a chapter. Which family member or chapter resonated the most with you?
Well, there is a chapter about me, so I suppose I should talk about that, in which I talk about myself as a migrant in two senses. One is that when I was a baby, my family moved to New Zealand from San Francisco, and then I lived there for the first 7 years of my life and then moved back. So until I wrote the book, I don't think I thought of myself as an immigrant, but in writing it, I came to realize that I did have a migration experience at the age of 7, and I had the usual trauma actually around that. And then when I was 19, I came out as a lesbian, and I have come to see that as another kind of migration from the old world to a new kind of cosmopolitan and more somehow expansive world. So those are my two migrations. Other than that, I would say that every person in the book is very dear to me. It was amazing to research the stories of my great-grandfather, who left India in 1909 and went to Fiji and died in the worldwide influenza epidemic 10 years later. So I never met him, but it was amazing to feel closer to him through the process of researching his story, looking at the newspapers of that time in Fiji to try to understand what the roads were like and what the people were like and what kinds of clothes people wore. That kind of intimacy that I came to feel with my ancestors was very special.
That's great. And can you tell us or describe for us what the Indian dream is?
Maybe Salman Rushdie is more qualified to answer this question. India is a country of 1.2 billion people, and so I think it's a country of 1.2 billion unique dreams. And in a sense, I also think those are just the regular human dream of happiness and peace and comfort for one's family and having enough. There is this now overlay of a new ambition, but I think that ambition is a bit different from a dream. And I think that on a day-to-day basis, most people in the world really want the same things. And the more that we become a globalized world, I think that's one of the benefits of globalization, which has certainly a lot of downsides, but one of the things that I think is amazing about it is that we do have the ability to connect across cultures and to see where there is common ground and what is common in our experience as humans and as mammals even, with other kinds of beings that we share this planet with. And on that level, I don't think there's a lot of difference between the dreams.
And you mentioned that there's a lot of non-Indian migration to India. Is there a model minority immigrant in India?
No. Most of the people migrating into India in the white-collar upper-class sectors are expats from Europe and America and Canada, who are there for a few years. They're getting some work experience. They're hoping to ride out the recession at home. They're hoping that these are resume building moves that will then qualify them for more senior positions when they get back. And very few of them are actually immigrants to India in the sense of someone who is planning to make their life there.
And then can you talk a little bit about some of the factors that are contributing to the pull away from the U.S. to India and other superpowers, in that, you know, I would think that particularly for Indian immigrants, there's such a high demand for the skill set and the level of training and education and expertise. What would be the pull?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that people are still coming for the training and expertise. and skill building. They definitely are coming. What I think is new is that fewer are staying. And it's not to say that no one is staying, because there's still a very large number of immigrants to the United States. The quotas are still full. There are still long waiting lines at the virtual border. So it's not that people are not coming. It's just that now some of those people have more choices, and there is a pull backwards. And, you know, I think about someone of my father's generation. My father came to the U.S. in 1963 as a graduate student. He came to do his master's. He stayed to do his Ph.D. During that time, Lyndon Johnson passed the Immigration Act, signed the Immigration Act, and so my father eventually became a citizen. But that was not his intention. His intention was to go back to India. And in 1974, he tried to go back to India. He went back. He interviewed for a job at a university. He was a professor of pharmacy. And in his interview, he was offered the job, and he tried to negotiate for a higher salary. And he was told, "We can't raise your salary, but of course you can supplement your salary." And he said, "How can I supplement my salary?" And the dean of the department told him, "Well, you know, some of the richer students, they will pay you for a better grade." And so that, for my father, was a deal breaker, and my father didn't feel that there was a place for him in his country anymore, and he came back first to the United States and then to New Zealand for a while and then back to the United States. Today, I think some of those things are changing. There is more transparency in some sectors than there was before. There are more jobs. The wages are more competitive with the multinational and international scales. So, and just the sheer size of the economy is really a draw, because that economy is expanding at a time when Western economies are shrinking. And what that means is that for every college graduate here, there are fewer jobs and more jobs over there. It's a very practical thing. And so in certain sectors, it's actually Indian companies are having trouble hiring people, which was never the case in the 1960s. Indian companies were always turning people away because the companies were smaller and the economy was more contained. So the liberalization of the economy there has really made these big changes for both people who come here and want to go back, and for people who are there themselves in India. And I do think that what is the pull that is still here in the West is the educational infrastructure. It is the kind of, you know, there is not now a Harvard or an MIT or a Stanford or a UC Berkeley in India. There are very, very good engineering colleges and universities, the IITs, and there are very good business schools that are emerging, but they're not on the scale that those educations are here, or at least people feel that they're not, which is almost the same thing when you're talking about merit and prestige. And that is going to change. And when India builds that infrastructure for itself, which it will, because now it has all of these people who are foreign educated, who are there, who have the skills, and some of those people will go into teaching, and some of those people are already setting up think tanks and departments in universities and programs. As that expands, the pull will be less to come here.
And you're speaking about the educational system in India, and one of the audience members' questions asked specifically about India's educational system. And since you've talked a little bit about what's going on at the university level, tell us about, you know, primary and secondary schooling in India.
It is extremely hierarchical, based on largely how much money you have, what kind of school you go to. There are schools that hold their classes under a tree in a village on chalkboards, and there are schools where you can walk in and have teleconferencing and whiteboards, and it looks just like the design school at Stanford. So it's very much tiered according to income. Most people pay something for their education, even in the public system. There are tuitions. Many, many, many children do not go to school at all. Many more drop out of school at a point pre-literacy, and many more don't finish high school. So the number of students who make it all the way through the educational system and into higher education is a minuscule proportion of the number of children who start out in the system.
And we'd like to remind again our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to India and Her Fragments, Migrations from Old to New Worlds with author Manal Hajratwala. Manal, does the present anti-corruption push on the fact that, you know, Indian society realizes that there has to be movement on this front, is it making progress?
It's a good question, and I am a journalist and a researcher and a historian, but I only tell tarot cards for myself, so I can't predict that. I do know from talking to people that there is a mix of opinion on it, and you know that is perhaps obvious, but there are people who feel that this current movement is very hopeful, and the fact that ordinary people are showing up for protests, and these are just regular middle-class people showing up by the thousands to protest corruption and ask for change, is very hopeful. And there are others who are quite cynical and say nothing is going to change this. It's too entrenched, and even if they set up these new anti-corruption bodies, those bodies themselves will quickly become corrupted and nothing will change. So it's really difficult to tell. And, you know, I think it is a good sign that whenever the people find a voice, I'm always in favor of that. But in terms of whether that changes things on a practical level, the forces driving corruption and keeping corruption in place are also extremely powerful. And when you have huge amounts of money floating around, and when you have even the multinational companies who come into India, they're also pouring their money into bribes because they feel that that's the only way to do business. And so they're also fueling the system. It's not as if the Western companies are somehow pure and corruption-free and are, you know, holding some kind of standard. No, they're doing business. Everyone's there to make money right now, and I don't see that changing unless there is some kind of very, very strong force on the other side, whether the government itself can find a corner of itself to free of corruption enough to have the authority to make that change. I'm not sure.
Getting back to your book and the fact that you have relatives that, I guess, migrated to 9 different countries in your family's diaspora, can you sort of give us an overview on how people fared by region? Mm-hmm. You know, the people, family members who came to America, where did they fare the best? Or, you know, family members who were in Fiji, how did they make out? Just...
Hmm. The family members who went to college did the best wherever they ended up, other than India. The family members who stayed in India are certainly the poorest. And they're not very poor, as in they don't live in slums or anything, but they are definitely working class. The family members who migrated are almost all much better off than the ones who stayed in India. In terms of regions of the world, no, I don't see that that has been a particular factor because, as with many migrants, when conditions changed, they moved on. So my great-grandfather, who went to Fiji in 1909, set up a department store, actually a small tailoring shop that later became one of the largest department stores in the South Pacific Islands. His sons ran it, then his grandsons ran it, and in 1987 there was a military coup in Fiji which devastated the economy and which was particularly targeted at Indians. Most of my relatives left Fiji after that, and they are those Fiji relatives are mostly in Australia and New Zealand now. Some also came to Canada and the United States. So they remade their lives and they are doing well. They're, in my family, they're mostly entrepreneurs, and I think that that gives them a kind of resilience where it's difficult to move and make change, especially for the older generation, but it is possible to start over and work those long hours again and build up the savings again, and that's what they've done.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. Manal, when and how did you make the decision that you were going to go back to India and perhaps stay?
I don't know the answer to that. I was thinking about it. I went there last October on a Fulbright research fellowship, which was a wonderful gift, and I was there to research a novel, which I'm still working on. And in my mind, when I had applied for the Fulbright, it was also a chance to try out living in India, which was something that I had thought, well, you know, maybe at some point in my life I'd like to stay there a little longer than a few weeks and get a chance to travel more. And maybe way back in the back of my mind was the idea that maybe I would think about moving to India. A lot of people are moving to India now among my generation, and maybe there's something for me there. And when I went there, I realized that what I had thought was a groove here for myself was actually something of a rut, and I was ready for a change. And so I'm really excited to move there at the end of this year and try it out for a longer period. I don't feel necessarily that I am moving there for the rest of my life, but I feel like I'm going to live there for a while.
Our thanks to Manal Hajrawala, author of Leaving India, for her comments here today.
Thank you so much.
And we also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.